Okay, welcome. Good morning. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 214 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. I'm going to be finishing GI for the Family Medicine Shelf. So if you listen to series, so I'm pretty sure this will actually be series, this should be series number 5, if I'm not mistaken. And once I'm done with this series, then we're essentially done with GI for the Family Medicine Shelf. So this is Family Medicine Shelf series review number 5, right? And again, I know some of you may be saying there are many episodes, but the thing is, notice I'm kind of limiting the length of these episodes. Like, for example, if the internal medicine videos, if I converted them to like these kinds of podcasts, there will be like 22 different podcasts, right? So, so just again, please bear with me. Family Medicine is a very comprehensive show. And I'm trying to make this as comprehensive as possible so that people, if you listen to this, you're like, okay, I've listened to a thorough, complete resource for this exam, especially if you want to like honor the shelf. So let's just go ahead and jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient has been having like bloody diarrhea for the past week and has right lower quadrant pain? What bug are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about Yersinia enterocolitica, right? Remember, Yersinia can cause a bloody diarrhea, but it causes this thing called a pseudoappendicitis, right? So it kind of feels like Crohn's disease or actually like appendicitis. And then if they give you a question about like an AIDS patient, right, that has, again, chronic watery diarrhea, I would really hope you're thinking about cryptosporidium, especially when they tell you that you check the stool and you see acid fast or cysts, right? If you see that, that's cryptosporidiosis. And then obviously, if a person recently completed antibiotic therapy or lives in a nursing home or just was recently hospitalized for anything, think about C. diff, right? Think about C. diff. Although for the most part, when people have diarrhea, it's usually from a viral cause, right? And for the most part, when people have diarrhea, again, just supportive care. That's all you pretty much have to do. But again, if a person's diarrhea is lasting for a pretty long time, let's say like more than a week, you can consider using antibiotics under those circumstances. And then if they give you a question about a person that, you know, like hikes or whatever, or a person that has IgA deficiency, and then again has like a chronic diarrhea, like a watery foul-smelling diarrhea, think about Giardia under those circumstances, right? And then if you see someone from like a developing country, like bloody diarrhea and has like a liver abscess, think about E. histolytica, right? And Entamoeba histolytica. And don't forget Giardia, E. histolytica, those respond very well to metronidazole, right? And remember that if a person has EHEC, right, enterohemorrhagic E. coli, 0157H7, no antibiotics, right, because you will increase the person's risk of having a HUS, right, hemolytic uremic syndrome. So you kind of want to be careful with that. And the thing is, in general, let me just tell you like a nice dandy general principle for MBM exams. If a person has, because remember, you know, sometimes when people have diarrhea, you can give them like loperamide and all that stuff, you know, to kind of help them with the diarrhea. But the thing is, if a person has bloody diarrhea in any way, shape, or form, please do not give loperamide or like diphenoxylate. Diphenoxylate is just essentially like loperamide, just a different name. Don't give any of those drugs, right? Because if a person has a EHEC and you give them loperamide, it actually raises their risk of HUS. And if a person has C. diff, if you actually give them loperamide, it raises their risk of toxic megacolon, right? So that's one thing you absolutely want to be careful of on exams for the most part. And I mean, if we're looking at like certain, if you notice that a person has diarrhea and some kind of fat malabsorption, one thing I'll encourage you to consider is maybe they have Crohn's disease, especially if it's like a chronic kind of diarrhea, right? There's this thing you want to be aware of known as the osmotic gap with diarrhea, right? So basically the osmotic gap, I almost think of it as like an anion gap for a person's, for a person's stool. Right, and really the formula is like 290 minus your sodium plus potassium, that's double, right? So you take the person's stool sodium, stool potassium, add it together, double it, subtract from 290. The way I think about it is, if there is a lot of electrolytes in a person's stool, like a ton of sodium potassium, that osmotic gap will be low, right? And that will tell you that, okay, oh, if there's a ton of electrolytes, this is more likely to be some kind of secretory diarrhea, right? But if there is not much in the way of sodium and potassium, it's just like a ton of like just other nasty stuff, they want to think about some kind of osmotic diarrhea, right? So like a lactase deficiency, for example. So an elevated stool osmotic gap, right? So usually it's more than like 100, like milliosmoles per kilogram. That's more like an osmotic diarrhea, like again, like lactase deficiency or like malabsorption kind of deal. But if the stool osmotic gap is less than 50, right? That means it's most likely like a secretory diarrhea. So like maybe like, I don't know, like carcinoid syndrome or like VIPomas with the WDHA syndrome and all that fun stuff. And then one trick that may also help you is just this thing. For whatever reason, people never pay attention to this. If they tell you that a person's diarrhea improves with fasting, it's likely going to be an osmotic diarrhea, right? Because if you fast, you're not going to be eating that stuff that can collect in your GI tract, pull out water, and cause you problems. But if a person's diarrhea does not improve with fasting, it's very likely to be a secretory diarrhea, right? So again, these are just all high-yield things to keep in mind. And I mean, like some classic things, right? Like if, for example, they tell you that, oh, a person has like, you know, this history of chronic diarrhea and they have these flushing episodes, that's going to be carcinoid syndrome, right? And obviously, you want to go ahead and check their urine for elevated levels of 5-HIAA, right? And then if you get a question about a person that has like a low BMI, is like super self-conscious and all that stuff, right? You want to think about those people that are kind of like inducing diarrhea in themselves, you know, like maybe like using laxatives and all that stuff, right? So people that are like, you know, like using laxatives. And usually those people that use laxatives, if you measure their stool osmolarity, it's usually less than 250, right? Having a stool osmolarity less than 250 when you have diarrhea is super weird. So if you see that, that's a very specific finding on NBMEs for people that are using laxatives to induce a diarrhea, right? And then if they give you a question about a person that, you know, has like, I don't know, like all these recurrent like bouts of pneumonia. Let's say this person is in their like 30s, for example, you know, recurrent bouts of pneumonia, sinusitis and all that stuff. And they keep getting like chronic diarrhea. And you're like, man, this person keeps getting giardial diarrhea. They want to maybe think about like IgA deficiency, right? IgA deficiency is something you want to look out for in your test. Because if you're deficient in IgA, right, you're not going to be able to protect your mucosal surfaces. And Giardia will have a field day in that person's GI tract, right? And then another thing that can also kind of present like that is CVID. CVID is something that can also cause a chronic diarrhea and recurrent pulmonary infections, right? So for those people, you know, just go ahead and check their levels of immunoglobulins. And if it's IgA deficiency, it will just be IgA that will be low. If it's CVID, pretty much all the immunoglobulins will be low, or most of them, right? And then don't forget, right, cystic fibrosis, right, can also cause chronic diarrhea from like pancreatic insufficiency. So you're not making lipase, so you have like a fat malabsorption, right? But again, CF, the person's symptoms will not start for the first time at the, like in their 20s or 30s. No, it'll be something they'll have from birth, right? And then don't forget that, again, this is something that you can see on a classic family medicine shelf. It'll be one of these questions that people are kind of scratching their heads, but it's like a very simple answer in front of you, right? So if you see a person that's, you know, taking like all these like sugar-free candy or like sour candy or whatever, or even these things that are like, these are like cough drops, right? And the person seems to have all these like diarrheal episodes and bloating. They usually have like pretty prominent bloating symptoms. Just think of like the artificial sweeteners in those things causing diarrhea. I mean, those things are actually a pretty prominent cause of diarrhea that you see in the office on a fairly irregular basis. And then if they give you a question about a person that once they eat, they have like, again, bloating, diarrhea, and they have like no alarm symptoms, no anemia, no any, like no crap going on, then maybe think about like a lactase deficiency. They may not necessarily put the dairy products in the question, but that's something you certainly want to consider on your exam, right? And then if you see a question about a person, you know, like a young person has like, again, bloating episodes, kind of feel they have like dyspepsia, and they tell you that, oh, when they poop, their symptoms feel a lot better, right? And again, they have like no weight loss, no electrolyte abnormalities on their labs. You want to think about IBS, right? Inflammatory bowel syndrome, right? And again, it's usually young people on NBME exams. And then if they give you a question about a patient and you're like, this patient is like, it's going to be a woman on your test, right? And she's going to be like between the ages of like 45 to 60. And, you know, she has just this chronic diarrhea. Doesn't seem to have any temporal association with consuming food. And then they tell you that, you know, you're like, you're kind of worried. You've tried every evaluation, nothing is happening. You do a colonoscopy and the colonoscopy is like stone cold normal. If you see that, you want to think about microscopic colitis, okay? So these people will have like, it will be like a middle-aged woman, chronic diarrhea, And it will usually be a woman that's probably like on some kind of like chronic NSAID for like arthritis or something, or like chronic PPI. And then they'll tell you that, you do a colonoscopy and you don't see squat, right? If you see that, think about microscopic colitis. And for the most part, you want to, you know, stop the NSAIDs and the PPIs that those people are taking. So again, just one of those weird things you want to keep in mind. And again, don't forget Giardia, hiker, person that drinks from a stream or whatever, right? And if they give you a question about a person that, again, like has like, again, chronic diarrhea, maybe fat malabsorption, again, youngish person, and the person has you notice that they have like a microcytic anemia, you know, very likely like an iron deficiency anemia kind of picture, please do not forget celiac disease, right? Celiac disease is one of those things you can almost guarantee you'll see on any NBM exam, right? And again, for those people, you want to get IgA against tissue transglutaminase. And then if you notice that IgA tissue transglutaminase is positive, then consider getting an EGD and then get some kind of biopsy, right? And for those people, again, gluten-free diet. And the thing is, if the IgA is negative, the IgA tissue transglutaminase is negative, you can also get IgG against tissue transglutaminase. Because remember, there is a very strong association of celiac disease with IgA deficiency, right? And then for these people, you want to make sure that, you know, they're kind of placed on a diet that's free of gluten, right? And then if they give you, again, a question about a person that has, you know, like been a big drinker for a pretty big portion of their lives, and let's say they stopped 3 years ago, and then you notice they give you all these labs, right? And you notice that this person has like a very high blood glucose. Think about a person with chronic pancreatitis. Again, they're not making lipase, so they have pancreatic insufficiency. I mean, if you want to do any kind of, usually if a person like has chronic pancreatitis, you don't really need to do any kind of like diagnostic testing on NBMEs, but sometimes they may get you to pick like checking their stool for excess fat. And again, they may even show you like an image and you see something sneaking across the middle of the abdomen. You see like all this white, right? That's chronic pancreatitis essentially, right? For those people, they need pancreatic enzyme replacement. And then if they give you a question about a person that, you know, has had like previous like resectics, like maybe they resected some part of their bowel, or they have like scleroderma, or they have like diabetic gastroparesis, and again, they have like chronic diarrhea with that, or they may even tell you that, oh, this person has like a macrocytic anemia with all these symptoms I just mentioned, think about some kind of bacterial overgrowth, right? Remember, bacteria can overgrow when you have like these, like you've resected the bowel or the bowel doesn't have good motility. People can have bacterial overgrowth from that. And bacteria, they love to consume a person's B12 and folate, right? Don't forget like Diphyllobothrium latum, right? That can cause like a B12 deficiency with a megaloblastic anemia, right? And then if they give you a question about like a middle-aged man, and this man has like all these like joint pain, has like neurologic problems or like cardiac problems or like eye problems, think about Whipple's disease, right? From like Trophoderma whipplei. Right. And for the most part, you actually need to do like a biopsy. Like you need to do like an EGD biopsy of the small intestine. And those people need like treatment for essentially like a year. Right. So just some, like, they need to be on antibiotics and they need to be on it consistently for a year. And then what if they give you a question about a person that goes to like some, you know, like, I don't know, like goes to like India or goes to like Puerto Rico. And then the person comes back and then the person has like this chronic diarrhea, like weight loss. They have like fatty stools. You want to think about like tropical spur, right? These people travel through the tropics and then they kind of get into trouble. People don't really understand the pathophysiology behind the tropical spur, to be honest. And really the way you treat it is kind of weird on exams, right? You actually treat these people with like either with like, you know, like Bactrim, basically any sulfonamide will do, or you can use like tetracycline, right? And then you add folic acid for those folks, right? And again, Giardia, I'm pretty sure I mentioned this a few minutes ago, you treat with metronidazole, right? And you check to make the diagnosis, you just check for the antigen in stool, and that's pretty much it, right? And again, celiac disease, I kind of talked about it already, again, has this association with gluten, and the way they usually set this celiac disease question up, right? Like they may have like fat malabsorption, they may have like a microcytic anemia, because celiac usually involves the small bowel, right? And your iron is reabsorbed in the duodenum, right? So if your duodenum is not working right, you get a microcytic anemia with that from iron deficiency, right? And then these people may have like dermatitis herpetiformis, right? So it's like they'll have like this rash on extensor surfaces. Remember, that typically responds to dapsone. And they can also have osteoporosis. In fact, one thing that your friends at the MBME can do for your family medicine shelf is they can give you a questionnaire. They describe a person that pretty much has celiac disease. And then they can ask for your next step in management. And it can actually be to do like check like their bone, like mineral density. Because again, people, there's a very strong association between celiac disease and osteoporosis, right? And the thing is, because celiac disease is an autoimmune disease, right? Like this is one mantra that I've seen like maybe like 95% of the time on MBME exams that detail any kind of autoimmune disease. When a person has one autoimmune disease, they have a pretty high risk of having another autoimmune disease. So if they're giving you an autoimmune disease question on an MBME exam, when they're talking about their medical history, they'll almost always mention some other kind of autoimmune disease those people have, right? And in fact, if they ask you like an epidemiology question on celiac disease, the most common like co-localizing autoimmune disease you may find in people with a history of celiacs is like type 1 diabetes and also like Hashimoto's, right? So those are things to keep in mind. And the thing is, again, they can give you like a question about a person that has like multiple autoimmune diseases, and then they throw in a risk factor question and say, oh, which of the following historic factors in this patient is the biggest risk factor for small bowel lymphoma? You want to think about celiac disease under those circumstances, right? And the thing is, people on MBME exams can actually have celiac disease without having Hashimoto's. Because the thing is, think about it. Where do you think thyroid hormone gets reabsorbed in the body? It actually gets reabsorbed in the GI tract, right? So if, let me not complicate this much. Let's say they give you a question about a patient. This patient has a history of Hashimoto's. And this patient is being treated with Synthroid, you know, like levothyroxine or like triiodothyronine. And you're like, man, this person doesn't seem to be getting better, and they have fat malabsorption with that. That may actually be a very bizarre but classic celiac disease presentation on exams. Because the thing is, if your small intestine is not working, if you're taking thyroid replacement therapy, it's not going to work, right? Because you're not going to be able to reabsorb it, right? So that may be, so pay attention to this presentation. This is actually a very high yield thing to know for exams. They give you a question about a person that has Hashimoto's. This patient is started on thyroid hormone replacement therapy, but you don't seem to be observing any effects from that thyroid hormone replacement therapy. And they tell you something about this person having like fatty stools and all that stuff. Think about celiac disease under those circumstances. Because again, your friends at the MBME kind of realize that, you know, all these testing resources and whatnot have, you know, put those classic questions where a person is taking like some kind of drug and they're taking thyroid hormone and that drug maybe binds up the thyroid hormone and whatever jazz, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind. That can be like a new, because the thing with the MBME is over the last like 8-9 months that's kind of making people scared of the exam is they are still seeing classic disease presentations, but they are seeing those classic disease presentations in unusual formats, right? So that's just something I want you to watch out for on exams. And again, don't forget that the antibodies against tissue transglutaminase are not the only celiac disease antibodies, right? Remember, you can also see like antibodies against anti-endomycial antibodies and antibodies against gliadin, right? And again, they can ask you a bizarre question and say like, oh, a patient has a history of celiac disease, they're started on a gluten-free diet, and their symptoms do not seem to abate, and they will say, well, what's the most likely cause of this patient's failure to respond to therapy? That would just be a non-adherence to their diet, right? Again, that's just one of those just simple things, but people tend to overthink on exams, right? And again, don't forget, celiac disease can cause like a, because again, you can also touch the terminal ileum, so you can get like a fat-soluble vitamin deficiency, so you can bleed from vitamin K problems. You can have like rickets, osteomalacia from vitamin D problems, right? Those people need like calcium and vitamin D essentially. You can have like acanthocytosis on a blood smear from a vitamin E deficiency. They can even get ataxia from that, or they can get like light blindness from vitamin A deficiency, or they can get like skin hyperkeratosis, right? So again, those are all things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And again, you can decrease a person's risk, right? Remember, whenever you can have like a lifestyle change that can decrease a person's risk of cancer, your friends at the MBME love to test those things, right? So don't forget, if you get a gluten-free diet, it will actually decrease the incidence of small bowel lymphoma, right, on MBME exams, right? In people that have a celiac disease, right? So again, celiac disease, the way you make the diagnosis, you check the antibodies first, and then after that, you need to do an EGD with biopsy, right, of the GI tract. So again, those are just all things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then if they give you a question about a person that, you know, a young person has just chronic bloody diarrhea, think about and this person, let's say they tell you that whenever they smoke, their symptoms get better. Think about ulcerative colitis under those circumstances. But if a person has predominantly like watery diarrhea and, they have like a lot of abdominal pain and they have like, you know, like a lot of like fever, like chronic fevers, they have like these fistulous lesions, right? So like maybe poop is coming out from the skin, or they have like poop coming out through like the urine because they formed like a fistula from the GI tract to the bladder. Think about, and let's say their symptoms get worse with smoking, think about Crohn's disease under those circumstances, right? And again, some of just these basic science details from step one, you may still see on step two CK and also your family medicine shelf, right? So people that have ulcerative colitis, they don't have skip lesions, right? Remember, the lesions are continuous. They may have like these crypt abscesses. And again, it only affects the colon, right? And it always affects the rectum on MBM exams. Contrast this with like Crohn's disease, right? Where they'll have like skip lesions. They'll have like granulomas if you biopsy those people's GI tracts. And they'll have like transmural involvement, right? So those are things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then don't forget, like one thing your friends at the MBME tend to feast on are just the other things that you may see associated with these inflammatory bowel diseases, right? Especially Crohn's disease, right? These people may have like aphthous ulcers. They may have like ankylosing spondylitis. They may have like essentially like those are seronegative or spondyloarthropathies, especially like the IBD associated arthritis, right? They may have like erythema nodosum, right? So that'll be a painful lesion on the lower extremities. They can have like pyoderma gangrenosum. Basically, pyoderma gangrenosum looks like erythema nodosum, but they have like a gangrenous appearance to the skin, right? They may have like uveitis. They may have like scleritis, right? So they may have like eye problems with those. And really, the way you diagnose Crohn's or UC is you go ahead and get a colonoscopy or biopsy, and that's all you need. And for the most part, one thing you may see that you may want to be careful about on exams, but this is probably more so step 2 CK. If you suspect the person has Crohn's or UC, you don't want to get a barium swallow on those people ever, right? Because the thing is, especially in people that have ulcerative colitis, it can actually trigger toxic megacolon. Right, so that's something you just want to watch out for. And if the person is going through like an acute flare, for the most part, you treat those people with steroids. That's pretty much all you need to do. And then for maintenance therapy, right, you want to go ahead and put them on like these aspirin derivatives, right? So like mesalamine, sulfasalazine, and all that stuff, right? Basically, those drugs deliver acetylsalicylic acid to the colon, right? And again, these are those people because you may see these like pneumococcal vaccination questions on your test, because again, it's a family medicine shelf. Remember, people that have just chronic diseases in general, like IBD, those people deserve those pneumococcal vaccines, right? And they should get their flu vaccines every year, like everybody should. And then remember that if a person has like, you know, like these IBDs and it's not responding to these like 5 ASA agents like mesalamine or sulfasalazine, you can consider studying those people on like the TNF inhibitors, right? So like infliximab, adalimumab, golimumab. Although don't forget, those people, they need to be tested for TB and for Hep B before you start treating them with any of those therapies. And then one nice way that your friends at the MBME love to give like a nice step one throwback on exams with even like this family medicine shelf is some people that actually get IBD, right? That have IBD, they are treated with like 6-methoxypyrenoate thioprene. Don't forget the association with, again, you may say, oh, Divine, this is step one crap. I don't care about this. I wish you all the best. But basically, the big thing I want to keep in mind is that if people have IBD, right, and they're being treated with azathioprine 6-methoxypyrenoate, you want to be careful of these drugs that are used for gout, like febuxostat or allopurinol, because those drugs inhibit xanthine oxidase, and xanthine oxidase metabolizes 6-MP makeup and isothiazepine to inactive stuff, right? So if you're inhibiting xanthine oxidase, those drug levels will build up. And then you, in general, before you start a person on any kind of therapy for like isothiazepine or 6-MP therapy, just again for purposes of MBM exams, check their levels of TPMT. TPMT is an enzyme known as a thiopurine methyltransferase. If you have no activity of this enzyme, you are at very high risk of like toxicity from 6-MP and isothiazepine. In fact, about 1 in 300 people lack this enzyme, right? So just check for TPMT activity. Again, it's just one of those bizarre, unusual new MBME questions you could see that could kind of throw you off balance. But hopefully it would not, because you're listening to this podcast. And remember, ulcerative colitis is curable if you get rid of those people's colons. So you do like a proctocolectomy. So you get rid of the rectum and the colon, right? Procto means rectum. And don't forget the association between ulcerative colitis and primary sclerosing cholangitis, where like your intra and extra hepatic bile ducts are all screwed up. P and K may be positive, right? They'll have a direct hyperbilirubinemia. Their ALK force will be high. Their GGT will be high, right? So those are just all things to watch out for. And I know I talked about microscopic colitis. For the most part, the way you actually treat it is, you can treat it with like an antidiarrheal agent like loperamide, or you can give those people like oral budesonide, like an oral corticosteroid. Again, stop the inciting agent, stop the ibuprofen, stop the PPI and all that stuff that may be triggering their symptoms. And then one thing I just want to talk about, if they give you a question about a person that has a history of chronic diarrhea, and then they tell you that, oh, you get a colonoscopy and you notice that those people have like this like black appearance of the colon, like almost like black colon, think about something called a melanosis coli. It's benign. You don't need to do squat for that. And then again, I've kind of talked about IBS already, right? They give you a question about a young person. They have like bloating, these like weird non-specific abdominal symptoms that get better when they poop. Or they tell you that, oh, their stool has changed form, their stool has changed frequency. That's essentially like the ROM criteria that I'm espousing right now. Think about IBS. IBS, there's many types, right? There's IBS-C, IBS-D, IBS-M, like the mixed IBS. And for the most part, again, people with IBS on MBM exams, they're not going to have a lab abnormalities. They're not going to have physical exam abnormalities. And for the most part, when people have IBS, there are many things you can use to treat them, right? So like if a person has IBS and they have like IBSD, you can give them like a tricyclic antidepressant. You'll essentially be taking advantage of its anticholinergic effects to fix their symptoms. If a person has like IBS-C, like IBS with constipation, you can give them these serotonin agents like lobeprostone. You can give them linaclotide, L-I-N-A-C-L-O-T-I-D-E, right? Linaclotide, that can help with IBS-C. IBS-D, again, I said, you can try a tricyclic antidepressant like imipramine. You can give them loperamide, right? Rifaximin may even be a drug you may see on exams. And then there's this drug you may see, and there is your friends at the MBA may begin to care more about this drug. It's known as Alocetron. It's a serotonin agent. It's very good actually for IBSD. But the thing is, you want to be careful giving people Alocetron. You typically want to try other agents first before giving Alocetron. Alocetron actually has a very strong association with ischemic colitis, right? So you just kind of want to be careful with that when you're prescribing that to people. And then as I wrap up here, if they give you a question about like an old person with like painless bloody bowel movements, think about diverticulosis. Diverticulitis, right, will be an old person, left lower quadrant pain, fevers. You make the diagnosis with a CT scan with IV contrast. Although usually if the symptoms are classic, you maybe don't even need to do any kind of imaging. And for the most part, those people, you know, kind of put them on like a clear liquid diet. You give them antibiotics, usually like the combination of like Cipro and metronidazole. And don't do a colonoscopy while they're going through the episode, right? You can perf the abdomen, and that would be like, you know, like bad. And one weird thing you want to keep in mind is if a person has like one episode of diverticulitis and then they have like a second episode, for the most part, you want to go ahead and refer them to surgery after the second episode so that you can reset that part of the colon. But the thing is, weeks after a person has diverticulitis, you absolutely need to consider sending those people for like a colonoscopy just to rule out a colon cancer. So just things to keep in mind for exams. And then I think let me just wrap up here. Let me just say the last thing I want to talk about. If they give you a question about a person, I've talked about this in many podcasts before, like a person with a history of AFib or recent MI, and they have like sudden onset severe abdominal pain, think about acute mesenteric ischemia, right? For the most part, you do like angiography, fix the problem. If bowel is dead, then you need to obviously refer them to surgery so that the bowel can be resected. And then chronic mesenteric ischemia will just be a person that has like really bad vascular disease, and whenever they eat, their belly hurts, so they lose a ton of weight because they don't eat, right? And again, you do angiography to make the diagnosis, like a CT angiography or an MR angiography. And that's pretty much all I think I'm going to say here. So I'm pretty much done with this. So as I do at the end of every podcast, I offer tutoring for many exams, step one, 2CK, 2CS, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. I do booster courses for step one, it's 20 hours, step 2CK, step three, it's 15 hours each. And then if you are a medicine resident, you need tutoring for like your board exams or the in-training exam, reach out to me. If you're a college student, you need tutoring for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, I tutor for all those things. And then if you need coaching, let's say you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS app, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS app, I do offer like, again, one-on-one coaching, one-on-one advising for those exams. Again, I have like 1 year's worth of admissions committee experience at a top two med school, actually, right? So the vast majority of people I've worked with have matched their first choices. So if that's something you're interested in, just reach out to me. Either send me an email through the, like reach out to me through the website, or you can send me an email at Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. Please subscribe to the website, subscribe to the podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Play. And I will see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you so much for listening to me. God bless you. See you next time. Thank you.